Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new movies, The Grudge. And that's it. That's the only new movie this week. They're not even taking stuff into wide release this week. It's just The Grudge. But I'll also be talking about my best and worst films of 2019. As well, there's going to be talk about the news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup looking back at the Star Wars prequels. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
I am part of the Columbus Film Critics Association. My hometown's Columbus, Ohio. And we had our awards just this past week. It's our 18th annual awards. And I don't disagree necessarily with whether these movies have merit. I'm not a big fan of the way everything shook out. But I think that looking at these awards give you a great example of how you can snapshot a group of critics. And you're going to get a very different appeal of different films. Like, for example, The Irishman was on our list in the top 10, but it was like number 8. Whereas the winner was Parasite, the Korean movie Parasite, which I thought was okay. I didn't cover it on the show, but I thought Parasite was a fine movie. I wasn't a huge fan of it, but I understand where there is a certain appeal to it. But what's interesting is our second film was Knives Out, and I will just say this. The group of critics that encapsulate the press corps from Columbus, there's a huge fan base of Rian Johnson. Knives Out went way higher on this list than I imagine on other best of lists around there. And of course, the director of Parasite, Bong Joon-ho, got named best director. What's interesting is the best actor was Adam Driver from A Marriage Story. But one thing I loved is seeing Lupita Nyong'o get best actress for us. We had the best supporting actor went to Willem Dafoe for The Lighthouse, which was one of my favorite movies of this year. So that was great to see. He beat Joe Pesci for The Irishman. And I imagine that was probably a pretty narrow win on that. And best supporting actress goes to Florence Pugh for Little Women. And I think she did a great job in that one. Ensemble was Knives Out, which again, not a big surprise considering a lot of the people voting for it. Same thing for best film editing. And the best original screenplay that Knives Out would lost to Parasite. If you go to Kafka, COFCA.org, you'll see the list there. And it's just worth looking at because this is a relatively small group of critics in Columbus, Ohio, as opposed to something like, you know, I also vote in the Critics' Choice Awards, which are next week, which is hundreds of people in an organization from all over the country. So whenever you get those regional film critic awards, I think that's interesting to look at because a lot of times you can see where regionally there's maybe certain love for movies that not anyone else has gotten. And if you go back and look at the best films that we've said over the years, yes, we get some of them like Million Dollar Baby or Gravity that had won Oscars, for example, or were close to winning Oscars, or Spotlight. We did Spotlight a couple years ago. But we also have stuff like Inception and Drive and Moonrise Kingdom, Selma. Last year, the group chose If Beale Street Could Talk. Some of these were movies that were in the running but never won any Oscars. So a lot of these regional awards are a great place for smaller, lesser-known films to get a fan base and win an Oscar. But that was our awards we had this week. And of course, next week, the Critics' Choice Awards, which is a much larger group that I'm a part of, on January 12th, that's next Sunday, at 7 p.m. on the CW, you can watch that award ceremony, and we'll see what happens there and see how close those mirror the Golden Globes, which are this weekend. But the Golden Globes, of course, are a little bit different because mainly they have that comedy and musical category broken out from drama, so you can spread around the love a little bit more. A lot of it with what's coming up for the Golden Globes is whether or not there's that much love for certain films like The Irishman or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood or Parasite, which you saw in our local Columbus area circle.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to hit is for A Quiet Place Part 2, which opens on March 20th.
I don't know why you came all the way up here.
There's nothing left.
Please. There are people out there worth saving.
You don't know, do you? I do. The people that are left are not the kind of people worth saving.
Of course, when I saw that this trailer was coming, I did sort of get a little bit nervous because a movie like The Quiet Place is a great movie, but it is murder to do a radio trailer for it because there's no dialogue in it mostly because they're trying to be quiet from these monsters. What's interesting is you can tell in the trailer, one of the first things they're going to do is they're going to go back to the beginning of this and show when this invasion or attack happened. And it looks very much like Bird Box. That sort of attack where people are driving and they suddenly realize something horrible is happening. So I did get a Bird Box feel to that, which is not, that's not accusatory. That's just, that's what, you know, apocalypse is going to look like from a certain point of view. But they do run into other people, so there's dialogue in the trailer. But I think what it does is this movie looks like it's going to be tackling a very different topic. In the first movie, obviously, it was how to survive and how to work as a family and work together in this very quiet, secluded way. This one looks like it's opening it up to a greater world and realizing who's left and what's left of humanity and whether that part of what's left is worth saving. And I think that's an interesting thing to look at. And I am looking forward to that because I'm curious to see what they examine there, because that is what all good science fiction does, is it examines the level of humanity. It's not just laser beams and shooting and space travel. It's examining humanity. And if you go back to early episodes of science fiction, either the books like the stuff from Jules Verne or Mary Shelley, but even going to Twilight Zone episodes or the Pulp Fiction from the 50s, it did look at how humanity existed and reacted to strange things and familiar things and what that meant for who we are as a species. So I'm looking forward to A Quiet Place Part 2. That's going to be coming up in about 2.5 months. And then let's look at the trailer for After Midnight, a smaller horror film, which opens on April 26th.
Listen, baby, you're going to talk to me sooner or later. You can't just disappear. Ever since you left, some kind of thing's been coming out of the woods every night.
Going around town telling people there's a big bad wolf trying to blow our house down.
Maybe she got tired of waiting around.
There ain't one town don't have someone saying they seen something they can't explain.
I'm not entirely convinced it's not you. You like a werewolf or something?
This one has my interest. And I've seen some of the movies the directors have worked on. I think they did a movie called Spring, the people who made this movie. And I wasn't a huge fan. I know there's a lot of people who really did enjoy that movie. I liked some of the ideas it had floating around. I thought it had some neat concepts, but it was not a perfect movie. This one, kind of like what I was saying with The Quiet Places, it's putting a mirror up against somebody and looking into them. It's not necessarily about a monster. It's about the monster inside of us. The big question is this going to be as much of a worthless type of movie as It Comes at Night, which meant to show that there was something on the outside, but then it was just, oh, it's just what's on the inside of you. There needs to be something real and tangible that people are fighting against, but it can be symbolic of something else. And I certainly think you're getting that with A Quiet Place. I think you got that with the first Quiet Place. After Midnight, I don't know. We'll see. If this is just some guy in a cabin going nutso, it may not be that good. I just hope that there's something with a little more meat to it. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about my worst films of 2019 when we return on Fat Guys at the Movies. We'll be right back. and welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the content. I'm not even doing film reviews on these first two segments here because we're going to talk about the year in review. We got to recap 2019. Now, you might be asking, what are you talking about 2019? It's 2020, man. Well, here's the thing. December is an insane month. There's Christmas and any sort of holiday that you're celebrating. There's kids getting out of school. There's plays and performances. And then there's a billion movies being released between the 13th and the 30th. I mean, there's so much stuff going on in December. And my head was spinning. I had more movies than I really had time to talk about before. So I said, you know what always happens? That first week of January is always a lull. I went back and I looked. Over the last decade, there have been one crappy movie released on that first weekend of the new year and nothing else. And with a few exceptions, there's some every now and then there were like two. But if we're talking like the last 10 years, it's always been some crappy horror movie. And I'm always there on Thursday night seeing it because I never screen it. So I'm like, this is the week to talk about the year in recap because there's nothing else new that's out in the theater. So let's talk about 2019. And one of my favorite things to do is I love doing worst of the year lists because there's some crap that comes out. And this is a chance for me to grind my gears and vent my spleen on having to go see terrible, awful, horrible, no good, very bad movies over the last 12 months. And I finally get to say these are bad. And so there's people out there like, oh, don't do worst of the year lists are nothing but engaging and Schadenfreude, or whatever that German word is for delighting in the misfortune of others. And it's just people trying to make art. Nah, I mean, it'd be one thing if you're going after some grassroots independent film that people gave up their life and their sweat and blood and tears. But if it's a professional movie made by a major studio, you do not get that luxury of hiding behind, I'm just an artist making a movie. Sorry, Michael Bay. That's not how it works. Michael Bay's not on this list, by the way. Just I was using him as an example. I haven't even watched his new movie. He's got a new movie, what, Six Underground on Netflix? I haven't had a chance to watch it. I've been so busy watching all this other stuff. Anyways, my top three worst movies of 2019 from 3 to 1. The first one, I'm just going to play the trailer and then we'll talk about it.
Please don't kill that man.
What?
I will give you $10 million. To drop my husband in the ocean for the sharks.
There's right and wrong, heaven and hell.
Some weird stuff going on right now. This whole island's a part of it, but nobody knows it.
Okay, John, you want the truth?
You don't.
This, if you don't recall, is Serenity. It came out almost a year ago. You'll notice a pattern. A lot of these movies are early in the year releases because January, February, even early March sometimes has some real garbage in it. Matthew McConaughey played this guy. He worked as a boat captain on this island in the middle of the Caribbean or whatever. And he was going to take Anne Hathaway's husband out and she was trying to get him to kill him, leave him for the sharks. And what's fascinating about this movie is that it had some great actors in it. I mean, McConaughey, you had Hathaway, you had Jason Clarke playing the husband, I believe. A lot of big names in this. It was an impressive cast. And it does some really intriguing stuff. It like really tries to do a twist. I mean, it's clever, but it's just ineffectively done. And the twist, it's one of those twists that almost works, but it would have to work and completely stick the landing. But even being a couple inches off, it just falls apart and it makes it a terrible movie. And this one, I remember when it came out, there were think pieces about how terrible it was. So yeah, that was number three. Now number two.
The Bible say, yea, though she walked in the valley with the shadow of Little Red Riding Hood and the three bears, she feared no evil, because the three little pigs was not around.
Amen.
Hallelujah. We here because your daddy dead. Now me coordinating the funeral. I hope y'all can appreciate what I'm going to try to do.
And if you need anything, just let us know.
I know it's about funerals. I done buried a lot of men. A lot of them.
That's right. What is a worst of the year list without a Madea movie? A Madea Family Funeral played, again, early in the year. I think it was a February movie. And it was, at the very least, you can say the Madea Family Funeral movie was what you'd expect from any Madea movie. You have this sort of mild morality play that's overly serious with some really contentious characters, bounced back and forth between that and the absurd, over-the-top, crazy Madea characters and like her friends and her brother, where he plays the different characters. But they go from these real down-to-earth, sometimes very depressing characters to these cartoon characters. And there's never a balance ever struck between this. Now, supposedly, this is supposed to be the last Madea movie. We can only cross our fingers and hope. I don't necessarily think that's going to happen, but man, I have seen so many of these, and they are all terrible. I mean, maybe if you go back to Diary of a Mad Black Woman, that one is okay, because I think he was really trying. By the time he got into just like these stuff like Boo and other later Madea movies, he was just saying, oh, I'm going to make Madea do her Madea thing. And he doesn't even put much thought into it. You listen to her in that clip riffing on the Bible verse. It's not even funny with the three pigs. And I mean, it doesn't even fit the character, even within the absurdity of the character. Anyways, so Madea Family Funeral, that was number two. But number one, nobody's going to recognize.
Do you think she suspects that you creep down to our bed?
Hmm? I thought we'd put Anthony down the end. It's not that kind of relationship anyway, is it?
If she does, that was an amazing performance. A very special tribute.
I don't think I am.
Oh, no, you don't think you are.
Very normal, really.
You're not normal at all.
I feel as though I want to not live my whole life in this very privileged part of the world I come from.
This was a little movie called The Souvenir. It's directed by Joanna Hogg. And what's interesting, you can find this on plenty of people's best of the year list. It's autobiographical, and the character in this is a filmmaker. First of all, any movie about a filmmaker, it has a great opportunity to be horribly pretentious. But the biggest problem with this movie, it was boring. It was so boring. It was so dull. Nothing happens in it, and what happens in it is so blindingly dull. I have had some personal things going on in real life outside of my radio work the last couple of years that have taken a lot of my time and energy. I'll admit, I end up dozing off a lot in movies, but I've also seen boring movies. For some reason, I was well rested when I went to go see this movie. I couldn't fall asleep, and I wanted to so bad. I remember sitting there at one point just closing my eyes, hoping I'd fall asleep, not caring if I was going to snore. Oh, my heaven. So yeah, The Souvenir, that's the worst movie of the year. And of course, there's other movies that were terrible. Some dishonorable mentions, Child's Play and Pet Sematary as remakes, as horror movie remakes. Those were terrible. Gemini Man, as cool as the technology was, it was still a terrible movie. Shaft was a major misfire. And then Lucy in the Sky. Here's one I remember saying, space shows up at the beginning of the movie and I rooted for space the whole time, and space never wins. That is a look into the worst that 2019 had to offer. I need to go to a break. When I come back next, I'm going to be talking about some of the best that 2019 had to offer on Fat Guys at the Movies. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the year in review of 2019. And again, I don't have to explain that, because if you were listening earlier, you understand that there was no time to review 2019 until 2020 started. So let's talk about some of my favorite films. And first of all, let's also talk about some of the big winners and losers. The big winner of 2019 was Disney. And it's not just because Disney knows what it's doing, although it does. It knows how to handle its properties. But Disney had the advantage of, because it had the Marvel and the Star Wars franchises, they had in the calendar year both the ending of the Avengers arc. I'm not saying the ending of the Avengers movies, because we got those coming out. We got a Black Widow movie coming out in May. But it's the end of that arc for the Avengers films that of course ties everyone together. You had that with Endgame this summer. And then of course, Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker was the ending arc of the three-part Skywalker sequel trilogy. For better or for worse, and for contention or not, and derailing and re-railing, no matter what, even if The Rise of Skywalker's final numbers aren't as good as The Last Jedi, it's still a billion-dollar movie and totally worth Disney making. And it's that gives them top six box office, domestic box office of the year. It just straight down. And I mean, these numbers are not final because, of course, obviously, Rise of Skywalker still has to continue to make money. And, you know, you don't know where Jumanji is going to end up falling in all of this. Because right now, it goes Avengers Endgame, The Lion King, Toy Story 4, Frozen 2, Captain Marvel, Star Wars Rise of Skywalker. And then at number seven, you've got Spider-Man Far From Home, which is Marvel adjacent. Then you have Aladdin, and then Joker and It Chapter 2. Warner Brothers has a couple ones in there. But most of them are Walt Disney, and they dominated box office-wise. They also had the launch of Disney Plus, which gave us The Mandalorian and gave us a chance to watch some old movies like The Black Hole and Tron. And so it's a big win for Disney. They're the winners this year. And, you know, Warner Brothers is one, too. They got some decent box office with, like, Joker and It Chapter 2. But they also are getting some awards traction. You could say that maybe the one of the winners was also Fox because you had the Disney merger. And Fox finally has a place to go. But right now, they don't know what to do with their stuff. So right now, that's all on hold. But going back to my favorite movies of the year, I'm just going to do the same thing and play the trailer, and then I'll talk about the movies really quickly. And this is what came in at number three.
Morning, Dan.
Morning, Senator.
Have you seen the story today in the New York Times?
Evidently, the CIA destroyed tapes of interrogations of Al-Qaeda detainees.
I want to find out what was on the tapes and why they were destroyed.
I vehemently disagree with the narrative here.
The United States does not torture.
Dan, you need to be careful here.
They can't destroy the documents. They can go after the next best thing, you.
What they really did was make it impossible to prosecute.
Yes, when you think of exciting film, you don't normally think of a 7,000-page governmental report. But that's what happened with the report. I loved it. I thought it was a fantastic movie. I thought it was at the level of All the President's Men in terms of dissecting the nuance of what goes on in a government document. I thought for as politically grounded this movie was, I mean, it was clearly an assignment under Dianne Feinstein's office, which is a Democratic senator. You can't remove partisanship from this movie completely, but you can see how it's trying to navigate a bipartisan government, even if you don't feel bipartisan. You have people from both sides in the government and how they tried to work to stay above board. But even just how it dug under all that and all the facts of the case had nothing to do with partisanship. It's a fascinating movie, and I think more people should have seen it. The next one in the list for number two is this one.
Are you ready for the best weekend ever?
Yes, I am!
Hey, Jojo, my old friend.
Hi, Adolf.
What's wrong, little man?
They call me a scared rabbit.
Jojo Rabbit!
Let them say whatever they want. People used to say a lot of nasty things about me. Oh, this guy's a lunatic. Oh, look at that psycho. He's gonna get us all killed.
Again, not to get political here, but I loved Jojo Rabbit because of several things it does. One of the things it does is it breaks down propaganda. Here's a child who lived his entire life in the Nazi regime, because he's like nine, and he's lived around propaganda all his life, and this is him reacting to the propaganda and trying to resolve all of it in his mind and realizing and coming to the realization and coming of age and realizing that the propaganda isn't true and that it's at times hilariously not true. And it gives him a chance to open up to a larger world. And this is what maturity is. But even as funny as this can be and as absurd and as silly, that last act of the movie is tough. It is an intense movie. and it has it wrestles with some great feelings. Jojo Rabbit's a fantastic movie. Again, more people should see it, but you have to understand it. It's not meant to make Hitler look like a goofy, fun, imaginary friend. It's there to show the impact of propaganda, real propaganda. I mean, the difference is between propaganda and news is if you're going to report the news, if you're going to look at news, you look at the events and the facts and you form that opinion, whether it goes to the right or the left. Propaganda is where you take a pre-existing opinion and then taking those facts and making it work and ignoring certain things and working around certain things. And there's a lot of that that goes on both sides for that matter. But propaganda is a dangerous thing. And especially the effect of propaganda on young children. You don't raise kids in propaganda because they'll eventually figure it out. But it's also a disservice to them. Teach your kids to critically think. Teach your kids to dissect any argument, whether you agree with it at the beginning or not. And that's really the heart and soul of Jojo Rabbit, about a kid who's learning to do that in the most unfortunate and horrible way possible. Now, my favorite movie of the year, this is very divisive, but here it is.
What made your last keeper leave?
He believed that there was some enchantment in the light. Went mad, he did. Tall tales. What? Let Neptune strike ye dead, Winslow!
The Lighthouse. I know nobody out there has seen it. I've been telling people it's great, but I also have been telling people it's not for everybody. I mean, The Lighthouse is this bizarre movie about these two guys going mad in a lighthouse, but it's not a movie about two guys going mad in a lighthouse. It has all the subtext and information that you can deconstruct and look at symbolism and what's the meaning of this and what's the cultural meaning of this. And going back to the old language of Herman Melville and how he wrote the language of people like Captain Ahab in Moby Dick. It's a brilliantly made movie. It looks gorgeous. If you missed it in the theaters, that's a shame because the surround sound of this movie is incredible. And it's not for everybody, but it's a great little movie. Now, other films that made my list, but didn't make that top three. Obviously, Rise of Skywalker and Avengers Endgame are in there as well. I was a fan of both. I thought they were great endings to both sagas. I think they left plenty of stuff open for more content, but also ended what they needed to end. Those are examples of movies that I thought were tentpole releases that completely delivered with what they needed to deliver. And so but those would be on my list. The Irishman also, mainly because it's sort of like this swan song for Martin Scorsese. It's tough. It's a long movie. It takes a while to get through. And it's a guy in his 70s making a movie rather than like a guy in his late 40s making a movie like Goodfellas. It's a fantastic film. And another one that's on my top 10 list that's worth noticing is Us. And yeah, it has some clunkiness going into that third act. But still, with what Jordan Peele was able to do, making it a truly effective horror movie, at the same time, making it a social commentary that you had to deconstruct and you have to challenge yourself to understand more than something like Get Out, which is all there on the surface. Anyways, that's it for the best of the year. And then we're going to be talking about what's clearly not going to be the best of this year in the next segment. And that will be The Grudge and The Box Office and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring a look back at the Star Wars prequels.
Stop it now.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I got one more, or only one total, movie review to actually do, and that is The Grudge. This is, of course, the only movie of the week and the first movie of the year. You know, since the likes of Leprechaun have we seen such lazy horror filmmaking. In this reboot of the Japanese ghost story, a violent death causes a deadly spirit to cling to earthly elements and transfer itself into a detective's life.
This is Detective Muldoon.
This is Peter Spencer. Something happened to me at 44 Rayburn Drive.
Someone was murdered at that house.
Why did you never go into that place?
Something never felt right about it.
Do you think that the body they found's related? Hello? I went to the house. Hello? Police department! I think something followed me home.
For the history of this, there was originally a Japanese movie, I believe it was called Ju-On, and it was a popular one, and back in around the turn of the century and a little bit past it for that first 10 years, there was this interest to mine Japanese filmmaking, because in the late 90s, in particular, Japanese horror stories were going into some really weird and interesting places. And also Hong Kong and some Chinese cinema and other things. But really Japan sort of spearheaded a lot of this. And it was very unique and different. And when it got imported into America, it was stuff we'd never seen before. And it reminds me, I was once having this conversation with this Chinese actor, and I forget his name. But he's been in things here and there. But we were talking about, it was at the time I was talking to him, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was a phenomenon in the U.S. And he kind of rolled his eyes at it. He's like, we've seen all that. We see that in Hong Kong filmmaking all the time. He's like, it's the first time you've seen it in America. And that's why you guys are going crazy. But he kind of poo-pooed Crouching Tiger as a piece of Chinese filmmaking. And I think there was a little bit of that going on with some of these Japanese horror films that were coming over, what they would call the time J-horror. And they imported The Ring, and The Ring was a huge hit because we'd not seen this imagery and this look. You see Ghost Story, and you got very American versions of a ghost story. But this one with the creepy hair and the wet, drippy lawn, I mean, they use a lot of hair motif in that, and the contortionist character of the girl from The Ring. And they followed that with The Grudge, where they had these creepy, ghostly figures in the background. And then after a while, more and more of these movies ended up getting English language remakes. And you just found that while it was an interesting look, it wasn't like everything was brand new and unique. Everyone's like, oh, this just looks like The Ring or The Grudge. Well, that's just sort of the visual motifs that finally made their way over in an artistic fashion. But at the time, The Grudge was a brand new, or with the exception of the Ring being out there, was kind of brand new, and it was a new look and got a lot of people's attention, and I really liked The Grudge. Now, the second movie, like they made like in 2005 or 2006, was kind of garbage. And then they made a third one. I think it went direct to video. But it's been over 15 years since the first American remake of The Grudge came out. Now, what they're trying to do is they're trying to reboot the series, and I think it's going to go about as well as when they tried to reboot The Ring movies with Rings. Part of the problem with this movie is, well, aside from the fact that it's just insanely boring, is it jumps around in time. It has some stuff taking place in 2004 and some in 2006. I think there's also like a contemporary element to it. I have trouble following it because it starts in like 2004 and then it bumps up, and I could never quite nail down when things were happening, because it was told out of chronological order. And so you had these three stories going on with this, basically these haunted stories, but I never quite got the point of each one. It was just the being, the entity was haunting everybody. But it was one of those things where you have all these great scenes of, oh, that was creepy. Oh, that was scary. Or, oh, they were attacked by the ghost. And then they cut the scene. They just end it. And I'm like, wait a minute, this person was just attacked by the ghost. We're not going to get any follow-up to that? And they just move on. It's the most ADHD presentation of the film. So the movie just doesn't quite hold together, and it's boring, and it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. I honestly don't. They had characters doing things that again, just made no pragmatic sense within the scene that's happening. It was lazy writing and lazy directing and lazy construction, and it's not a surprise that it came out first week of January. So I'm going to have to say it totally sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the box office from last weekend. Not a huge surprise, but of course, Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker came in at number one. Yeah, it dropped like $100 million, but it was only like less than 60%, which isn't bad for an anticipated film. Still, like 70-some million dollars is the opening. Jumanji's running behind that, and then, of course, Frozen 2. Little Women came in with just under 17, and Spies in Disguise came in with about 13.5. It's the Star Wars Jumanji 1-2 punch that's dominating the box office, and will probably dominate this weekend as well. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week I thought it would be interesting to go back and just really quickly address the Star Wars prequels, episodes 1, 2, and 3. Because, like many people, I went and rewatched all the Star Wars movies. Now, I know a lot of people watched them leading up to going to see Rise of Skywalker. I didn't have time for that. I had to wait until after Christmas. And then, like, my son and me and my wife, we watched all 8 movies. And obviously, I love 4, 5, and 6. I grew up with those. Those are great movies. I will love them forever in my life. And, you know, even the special editions that are available most places, they're okay. I mean, it gets a little goofy in some parts in both Star Wars and Jedi. But overall, I can forgive a lot of the post-release tinkering by Lucas. Now, episodes 1, 2, and 3. Everyone loves to dump on those. But I want to talk about those really quickly. But let me just play the trailer just to give you the idea of the anticipation. If you remember, more than 20 years ago.
You refer to the prophecy of the one who will bring balance to the Force. You believe it's this boy?
He can see things before they happen.
He can help you.
The Force is unusually strong with him.
Anakin! Tell him to take off!
Are you sure about this? Trusting our fate to a boy we hardly know?
Anakin Skywalker, meet Obi-Wan Kenobi.
I sense much fear in you.
The boy is dangerous. They all sense it. Why can't you?
One of the things I respect about Lucas with these releases is he didn't just rehash episodes 4, 5, and 6. And as much as everyone likes to dump on the prequels, they were different movies. They were not just Star Wars Empire Jedi again. These are wholly different stories. Now, granted, there's not a whole lot of story in the original episode 1. But I can forgive that for the richness of the universe he was developing. He gave us a bona fide look at what it was like to have all the Jedi around and be in control. And you have this galactic republic that's living mostly in peace. And yeah, there's, you know, stuff going on in the outer rim that is not easily policed. But I mean, you see a galaxy at peace and you get to see somebody come up from the inside and destroy it, which is basically what Palpatine does. So first of all, I give Lucas lots of respect for doing something different. The other thing he does is he mirrors the original serial feel to this, not only with the title Phantom Menace, which sounds very much like a 1940s serial, but using some of the racial issues, things going on. I mean, the Trade Federation are the yellow-faced bad guys that you always had in these serials in the 40s. And the crawl and the characters and you know, yeah, the younger whiny kid, but there's always a younger whiny kid. There's always that gee whiz element to it of 40s filmmaking that works in this stuff. And I respect Lucas for putting it in there and sticking to his guns. On top of all that, I respect Lucas for never having to explain that. He just did it. He didn't feel the need to go through a long explanation of, well, this means this and this is this and this. I put this in because of that. If you have a knowledge of these original serials, go back and watch them. You can find a whole bunch of them on YouTube. Go back and watch some Flash Gordon or Terry and the Pirates or Rocky Jones or any of those cheesy, you know, especially the Jungle Adventure ones, you know, stuff like Terry and the Pirates, which is one of the best ones to follow. If you really want to see what a Star Wars movie was based on, go watch Terry and the Pirates. Finally, on everything else, I mean, yeah, there's problems. Jar Jar was a mess, and Hayden Christensen wasn't a great actor, and Natalie Portman wasn't directed at all, and she kind of comes off looking terrible. But for what it's worth, the effects hold up. I mean, those effects are 20 years old, and they look great still. I mean, there's stuff you can recognize as being older effects, but they don't look like Spawn. You know, they don't look like Species. They don't look like those movies that came out in the late 90s that just started using digital effects. Some of the stuff looks really good. Some of it doesn't. And sometimes it breaks down. But for the most part, you watch Phantom Menace, came out in 1999. It still looks marginally pretty good. And that's, you can't say that a lot about CGI movies from the late 90s and early 2000s. So I'm going to say they totally rock.
It rocks.
Excellent.
And that is it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Like a Boss and Underwater. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.